Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Right now, right now.
Now's the time to do the right thing.
That's right. Stop the fussing and the fighting. Let's do it right. And we got a lot to cover today. And one of the things we got to do right is to pay attention to our health. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And I'm coming from Black Radio Hall of Fame at Harris Stowe State University. This program is all about bringing the voices on the battlefield. And we have a special guest today. And her battlefront is health and education. We are privileged and honored to have Dr. Lisa Kilpatrick with us today. And, you know, people always laugh at me because I say people have a lot of alphabets behind their name, but you literally do have a lot of alphabets behind your name. So Dr. Lisa is an MD. She's an MPH, which is public health, but she's an MPA. She's also a board certified infectious disease physician and a medical epidemiologist. But, you know, she's got quite a storied career because she started at the Epidemic Intelligence Service with the CDC. So she knows about health and she knows about Black health. So we're going to be talking about health equity today. But I want to first welcome you to the show, Dr. Lisa Kilpatrick.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here. And I just have to correct you. You said my last name is Kilpatrick. It's Fitzpatrick.
I mean Fitzpatrick. So I don't. Yes.
This is why I tell people just call me Dr. Lisa or Dr. Fitz because then you don't have to worry about it. So.
And you know, but I just call you Dr. Lisa, but I'm yeah. I need to say the whole name for our listeners. Yes. Thank you for that.
Yeah, no problem. And you didn't tell people I'm from St. Louis.
Yeah, well, I was going to mention that because how I find out about that little bit of tidbit was just from starting to work with you in a more deeper way. And so we had a chance to go through the 22nd Ward and look at some of the conditions that affect our people. And we talked about how those kinds of environments impact people's health. But I really wanted you to start off talking about what I think is a unique organization, and that's Grapevine Health. And I say unique, and maybe it's other ones across the country, but when you look at, for example, the crew, and you see medical people, and you see people that are, their title is a podcast coordinator, you see somebody that's a production manager, you're like, what is this? So talk a little bit about how it came up, and then what you all do, and why you do.
Yeah, thank you so much for asking those questions. I enjoy talking about this journey. And it's really important for our people to understand why Grapevine Health needs to exist in the world. You talked about all the different jobs I've had. But when I was at CDC, I was at a community event sponsored by 100 Black Men. And it was a panel of health experts, and the community just really wanted some basic health information. But a lot of the people on the panel were talking over everybody's head and talking about all of their accomplishments. And I was just keeping it real. And that's kind of what I do. Like when people in my family, like I just said, I'm from St. Louis. So my family would ask me some of these basic questions that doctors take for granted. People know because we don't spend the time to help people understand. So this man walks up to me at the end of the event and he says, "How does someone like me access someone like you on a regular basis?"
Yeah, good question.
Right? And so we talked a little bit about his health needs and how he felt like he couldn't understand most of the things his doctor said or why he was on medication. And that really stayed with me. I mean, that was over 25 years ago, and I still remember, like, he asked me yesterday. And the reason that it stayed with me is because I know that so many people in our communities need access to trusted health information. We saw that during the pandemic, didn't we, Ms. Rogers?
Yes.
Just people not knowing, like, who to trust or what to believe. And so I thought, well, I'm one person. I have a full-time job. How could I use my skills of educating people in a plain way to reach many more people who probably have the same question this guy did? So I created a video series called Dr. Lisa on the Street. And you can find some of those videos on YouTube if you just Google Dr. Lisa on the Street. And I thought, well, using video, I could, what we call democratize or spread the information to many more people who could get it through their cell phones or on the internet. And so Grapevine really is the evolution of Dr. Lisa on the Street. So what we do now, and we are very activated during the pandemic, we do webinars to have people ask doctors questions, like questions, there's no judgment, no shame. You can ask any question, even questions you think you need to know that you should already know the answer to. We don't care. We will answer your questions and not take anything for granted. But we also are creating video content. And the purpose of the video content, and this is why we need a producer and why we need all these media people to help us, is because despite there being a ton of health information out there, you can get health info, you can Google anything you want to. But do you know what to do with the Google results? And do you understand it? And does it send you down a rabbit hole when you just want the answer to your question? So what we're trying to do at Grapevine is just be that pipeline, that go-to source for simple to understand, trusted health information for the Black and Hispanic community. And we started focusing on the Black community, number one, because that's my community. But number two, if you look at who's dying the most of chronic health conditions, or who has the highest number of health conditions, it's us. And a lot of it, I think, is linked to not really understanding how to take care of ourselves. So that's what we do at Grapevine. We talk to people, we create video content, we put it on social media, on the internet, and we host these sessions so that people can get access to doctors like me.
So I definitely appreciate that approach, because one of the things I know for our people is that they are intimidated when they go to a doctor's office. And that's even if the doctor's halfway friendly, you know, or welcoming. It's like we feel like we don't know enough and we can't ask questions, we can't challenge them. And the thing that I always tell people, okay, this is your health. The doctor is your partner in your health journey.
You have to
do whatever it takes to communicate with that person, because if not, then what's the point of being there? And then when you feel like you've been wronged or they didn't hear you, then you don't want to go. And you don't want that. So I really get that. Now, can you tell us a little bit? I know you all work with agencies and helping them with their cultural competency and also helping them to develop, you know, literature, you know, videos to be accessible to their clients. But what about directly with the public in terms of if it's beyond, you know, ask Dr. Lisa, how else can they access a group like yours or the information that you're bringing?
Yeah, we're trying to build our audience, Ms. Rogers. So this is helpful, just even having me be on your show. People can access us on all the social media channels. We're not, just be honest, we're not that great on TikTok, but we're probably going to be there eventually. And Grapevine's a fairly new company, so, you know, it takes time to build a following, but getting the word out is what's most important. Instagram, Facebook, we're on Twitter, but Twitter is, you know, it's hit or miss on Twitter. And then our YouTube channel. We really want people to follow our YouTube channel and engage in the comments, because somebody's reading those and we will respond to you. Maybe you have a question. Maybe you have a topic you want us to cover. And then finally, if you go to our website and sign up, then you can get information from us. You can also submit a question through our website. So there are many ways to reach us. And finally, if people don't want to get on the internet at all, they can send us a text message, and that number I can give to you, 202-702-8175. Anybody can send us a question, and we'll do our best to respond to their question. Now, we're not giving medical advice. I just have to make sure people understand that. We are not your doctor. We are trying to help you understand what your doctor said. Or if you're afraid to go to the doctor, we are here to help you understand, okay, could you have high blood pressure? Here's what you might look for. Are you having blurry vision? Does your head hurt when you wake up in the morning? And is it throbbing? Are you tired all the time? So that's the kind of information we give people so that they know what they should be looking for and when to go to see a doctor or to ask questions.
So I think that would be a helpful mechanism because you are totally unknown. There's no judgment. And so,
yes. You
know, people feel more comfortable with pouring out their hearts to people they don't know. That's why they have all these calls.
That's right.
Yeah, so you can really like get your bar down. So I think that's an excellent way. And we're going to repeat that text number so that people can get it more than once and have a chance to write it down. So the other thing I'm thinking about, Dr. Lisa, is when we talk about health equity, how do you define that? And why is that important to African Americans?
Yeah, I'm glad you're raising this. It seems like in the health field, everybody is talking about health equity now. It is a buzzword that's everywhere, but you don't see a lot of action behind it. To me, health equity is no matter who you are, what your zip code is, how much money you make, you can get access to the things you need to live a healthy life. And so if you look in society, almost any city, you will find people who are largely, groups of people who are largely healthy and largely unhealthy. And a lot of that is going to be determined by zip code. Are the services there? How easy is it to get to the doctor? If you want to eat fresh fruits and vegetables or grow your own, do you have access to those things so that you can eat healthy? Do you even know what you need to buy or do to make healthy food? Do you have reliable transportation to get where you need to go? Do you have a job that pays you enough so that you're not stressed out all the time? All of these things are linked to our health. And they're also linked to health equity. So it's hard for people. If you're poor, which in the United States, a lot of Black people are poor, don't have access to these things. And that means we have health inequity. So the goal is to get to health equity so that people have the resources and the know, you know, they have the information they need to be healthy.
That's basically my definition, except I would add to that, and this is what I'm thinking about political equity and economic equity.
Mm.
It doesn't mean the same. Equity does not mean the same. Like, it's not equality. Equity means you get what you need. That might be different from what somebody else's needs. So when somebody says, the education formula the same. No, it can't be the same because certain districts have greater needs. And so the equity allows you to level out the playing field. So yeah, we want equality, but we want equity more than equality. So, but one of the things you all mentioned, and I got this from Grapevine Health, is you say over half of the U.S. adults have trouble understanding and interpreting health information. I'm wondering what that is for Black folks. If it's over half for adults in general, what would it be for Black folks?
So, and it's an interesting question because it's really not about race. It's actually linked to education. And also, let me just be honest. We don't have great ways to measure someone's health literacy. So how easily do people understand the health information they see and hear, and are they able to use that information to be healthy? We need to find a better way to measure that. And so what we do is we use proxies or things that are close enough that we can, you know, make a judgment about, okay, is this what health literacy is? And so I'll just give an example. I talked to a man, he was probably in his 70s, who only used the emergency department for his healthcare. And he'd been doing this for years. And when I talked to him about why he was doing that, he didn't really have an answer. He also wasn't able to really describe to me what his health conditions were and said, well, you know, when I don't feel good, I just go to the ER. And so one way you might judge someone's health literacy is about how they can actually describe what's going on with them and their understanding of it. But the other thing is, do you know what to do once you think there's a problem? And so in his case, he only went to the emergency department. And Ms. Rogers, it turned out, I know you want me to call you Jamal, but I like calling you Ms. Rogers.
Okay.
it turns out this gentleman could not read. Now think about how difficult it is to engage in healthcare. Just, you know, in your mind, when you go to a doctor's office, what is the first thing you have to do? You have to sign your name. You have to fill out the form. And the form is multiple pages. It can be very intimidating for someone who can't read. But if you go to the emergency department, you can actually fake it and get people to do all that stuff for you, right? So that, he is, to me, a really powerful illustration of not having the health literacy you need to be healthy. And so he's just found a workaround. The other ways we measure health literacy are around, do people understand, you know, if we prescribe a medicine, do you understand how to take it? Do you understand what, you know, when a side effect comes up, do you recognize that? But we've done a really lousy job at this, both communicating health information and figuring out who needs the most help with it. But I think the best indicator is usually someone's reading ability. But I've had college people, you know, college graduates tell me this is difficult. But the difference is if you're a college graduate, you probably know people. You probably have connections or know someone who knows someone you can reach out to get the answer. So we're right back to the guy who asked me, how does someone like me access someone like you? So you or I could probably easily just pick up our phone and call someone. Whereas he feels like, I don't know anybody who can help explain this to me. But again, that's why Grapevine exists.
Yeah, that's a really powerful example of the guy who couldn't read and why he was going to the emergency room. And he would think if he had been doing that for years that somebody in that emergency room would say, sir, you can't keep doing this. Let's get you to a physician that can be a regular healthcare doctor so that it's about wellness, not about crises that you find yourself in. But I think, you know, I've seen a lot of people, Dr. Lisa, go from going into the emergency room, as you described, to going to urgent care.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I went to urgent care. I was like, okay, those are stopgap measures. But they heard so much about don't go to the emergency room that because now this is set up, it looks like a stopgap. So what about that? Because that's not your physician that's going to follow you. So how should those be used?
So that is a great question. So urgent care and emergency, the difference is, do you feel like you're going to die? Is it life-threatening if you don't go get help right now? Urgent care is, oh, this thing came up. My doctor's office isn't open until tomorrow, but I'm feeling, you know, some discomfort or I need help with this thing. Stitches, a good example. Bee sting, good example. There's so many reasons you might go to urgent care. I think I have an earache. Like, what's going on? Do I have strep throat? Those are reasons to go to urgent care because none of those things are life-threatening in this moment and will kill you. But unfortunately, we don't have a great urgent care system throughout the country. And so sometimes people don't have another option than to go to the emergency room. And that's why we tell people not to go to the emergency room for a couple reasons. One, if the emergency room is overcrowded and someone who comes in and has a true emergency and they can't be seen, you're putting that person's life at risk. The second thing, though, is a financial one. And I'm not sure if this should carry as much weight, but the cost of seeing someone in the emergency department is much, much higher than having a primary care doctor. And so I don't want to get us off in that, you know, conversation about how terrible our healthcare system is and how expensive it is. But those costs add up, and you know who's bearing the costs, especially for Medicaid and Medicare patients. It's you and me. It's the public, because our taxes support the healthcare provided by Medicaid and Medicare.
Yeah. So this is Jamala Rogers with Voices from the Battlefield, and we're talking today with Dr. Lisa Fitzpatrick, who is on a unique journey to not just health literacy, but health equity. And so her background is professionally a medical doctor, but she's gone so much, much further. And Dr. Lisa, I noticed that I've seen a number of physicians who went into the field thinking treatment. And then after they're there for a few years, and particularly if their clientele is black, they're like, okay, something is not right here. I got to get in front of this. And I've seen them go from, you know, being a health, a medical doctor to more of a holistic doctor, or maybe to a doctor that's prescribing more than just medications. And so I'm just wondering, it must be difficult. I've heard people do this in law when they get in there, like, wait a minute, I got to send black people to prison for, these are the laws that are in place that I have to work with. So the tools are not necessarily there for you to have interventions that's going to really impact the clientele that you're working with. But I just, and keep going back to the conditions. And so African Americans are more likely to have high blood pressure, diabetes. They're more likely to be obese, which is a risk factor for cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. I mean, at every level, whatever the medical condition is, it's going to impact us disproportionately. So you have African Americans ages 18 to 49 twice as likely to die from heart disease than whites. African Americans from ages 35 to 64, 50% more likely to have high blood pressure than whites. And so when I started to look at these, and even for black women, breast cancer and cervical cancer, higher incidence, more likely to die. And the cervical cancer is personal to me because of my older sister died of cervical cancer, and it was misdiagnosed. So by the time they found out it was cancer, she was in stage 4. So I'm just looking at all of these things, these conditions that are outcomes of our environment, and looking at, okay, I got high blood pressure in my family. I got diabetes in my family. What can I do to mitigate me having to then take an insulin or going to dialysis? You know, when you talk about how you talk to people and you see the conditions that they come from, what are some practical things that you can tell them to do?
Yeah, there's so much there. I think, the first thing I'll say though, after hearing that, you know, people might feel a little sad or depressed, but there is hope, and the hope is in knowing that we can't control some of this. But you have to make a decision that you want to get on top of it. I'm going to come back and talk to some of the structural issues, because there are reasons you see higher rates of all these diseases in the black community. But first, let me just talk about the black community and we as individuals, what we can do. Let me take swimming as an example. I was in an elevator and I had my bicycle helmet on. So I try to be active, not as much as I used to. I'm trying to increase that. But this black man was in the elevator with me. He said, oh, you rode your bike here. And I said, yeah. He says, I sure wish I could get my wife and my daughter to ride bikes. I was actually trying to get them to learn to swim. They told me they didn't want to mess their hair up. And it actually led me to write a blog, which I'll send you. It's about how the beauty industry is fueling the obesity epidemic. It's actually not the beauty industry, right? It's our devotion to buying into the philosophy, buying the products, and being more concerned about how we look on the outside than how we are on the inside. And so there's a lot of social pressure to look a certain way on the outside. But is that more important than your health? And so what decisions are we making about our own health when we say, I can only work out on Friday? And these are things I've heard. I can only work out on Friday because it messes up my hair because I'm going to the beauty shop on Saturday. And so the rest of, so if you get your hair done every 2 weeks, you can't work out or even sweat a little bit because you don't want to mess up your hair. And then the amount of money we spend on things. And so we talk about how we can't afford this or that. Fruits and vegetables are so expensive. How much money are we spending on things that don't help us to be healthy? And I'm not calling anything out because I don't want people to get mad and throw eggs at me, but you know what I'm talking about. We do have challenges though in our neighborhood structurally. A patient's telling me I don't feel comfortable walking in my neighborhood. I know I need to exercise, but my neighborhood is dangerous. You know, I'm afraid, you know, for my son, my teenage son to be outside. Like these things are real. And access to healthcare. Consistent access to good healthcare providers who care about our community will take the time and will listen to us and not dismiss our complaints. Now, there's a lot of talk about racism in healthcare. It exists, but I think healthcare providers in particular are quick to dismiss people's symptoms. I mean, I used to do that because we've been taught a certain way and we're looking for certain things. And if your story doesn't match with what I've been taught, then my instinct is to say, oh, that's not really this over here, right? That's something else. Mm-hmm. And so I've learned over time that we need to listen to people because we don't have all the answers and the way it's presenting for them might be unique. How do you think discoveries are made? Because something comes to your attention for the first time or you're looking at it in a different way. And so I think these, you know, Black people often, especially in some of the lower income zip codes, are at a disadvantage. So if you pile on racism, lack of time, the judgment, the biases that providers have or healthcare, you know, providers like doctors and physician assistants and nurses, these biases, you know, they accumulate over time, so much so we don't even notice them. And what ends up happening is that we might deliver inferior care to people because of who they are. So their race or their zip code or their income. And then a lot of the doctors who work in the communities that serve our people, they're overstretched and underpaid. So they may not actually have any ill will to their patients, and I would venture to guess none of them do. It's just we're working in a system that is so broken, has so many challenges, like, you know, the structural racism. Why is it so hard for someone who's poor to get the same level of care as someone who's not? And why are Black people disproportionately in certain zip codes? Like, all of that is by design. And so we have a lot against us, and that creates stress, which is the take-home point. Black people largely have highest rates of these health conditions because it can be very stressful to be a Black person in the United States. And so what is that stress doing to your body? It is creating, if you're feeling anxious or you never have opportunity to relax, if you're not exercising consistently, doing things to offset the stress impact on your body, the disease can take over. And over time, that builds up. You get high blood pressure. Your body's getting inflamed all over. You get kidney disease. You get heart disease. You get cancer. So that's why these doctors you mentioned are turning to holistic medicine, because they realize we're tired of just giving people pills. And if the root cause of what's making us sick is the stress imposed by being a Black person or being, you know, some place where you don't have all of your needs met. And how do we help people either cope with that, or can we do something to help them besides giving them pills? You know how many people have accused doctors of being drug dealers?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, yeah, so I hear this all the time. Yeah, and so on my social media, I have an Instagram page, Dr. Lisa on the Street, and I'm going to start talking about this on that page because choice is ours in some ways, right? Reason doctors are always prescribing medicines and it feels like we turn to that first is because probably on the first 2-3 visits, we talked about, well, are you walking more? What changes have you made in your diet? Oh, are you getting enough sleep? If none of that is happening, your health is not going to improve. And so the only reason to prescribe a medicine is something in your body is no longer working. And so if you aren't doing something to try to fix it, then the pill is going to substitute. And so again, and you know, a lot of times these conversations devolve into name calling and saying, you know, you're blaming the victim. That's not what this is. Like you have to be truthful because there's responsibility on both sides. Besides, who wants to be sick anyway?
Yeah.
Say it. If you want to stay out of the healthcare system, do anything you can. Like even the poorest person can find and make time. If you have two jobs, like I've heard everything. Well, I have two jobs, I don't have time, and I have three kids, and by the time I get them to school, and then I work two jobs, like I don't even have 5 minutes for myself. That's not true. You have to sit down and plan. You know, we may not be good at that, or maybe no one has shown us how to do that. So I'm rambling on, so let me stop.
No. This is absolutely on point, because you and I have talked about being healthy is a radical act. That's my philosophy. And so when you talk about these systems of oppression and structural racism, to be healthy is a in your face kind of thing. Like I've resisted all of that you put in front of me and I'm still healthy. And that's a radical act. But you know, the whole thing of what causes stress. I think about while you were talking, I was thinking about all the data around infant mortality and what the data has shown over a number of years is that Black women who are poor and Black women who are middle income are basically at the same level with infant mortality. And the common denominator is stress. Because you're Black in America, you're a Black female in America. So even if you have the resources and income to help mitigate some of that, the impact is still the same. And to me, that's such a sad commentary on this country. But again, like you said, it doesn't mean that we have to stay that way. We have to take some responsibility. So to that end, and we touched on a little bit about what are some of the healing strategies that you suggest to people that you talk to increase their mental health, their ability to cope with racism and the stresses in their life. Because as you know, those are connected. Your physical, mental, psychological well-being are all connected. They're not separate. And that's another thing that I don't think physicians and healthcare professionals are telling people. When you got all this other stuff going, you can't possibly be healthy. They're all interrelated. So what are some of the strategies that we can use for that? Yes, we don't have time. Yes, we're overworked, we're underpaid. Yes, there's lots of violence in our community. But what can we do for ourselves and our families?
And so the thing we can do is to do activities that offset the stress, right? So the impact of stress, these fight or flight hormones, that raises your blood pressure, raises your heart rate, like gets you in a state like you're ready for attack or to defend yourself. People who are poor and live under this kind of stress basically are rumbling at that high level. That's that intense state all the time. And then over time you get used to it so you don't notice it. Being at that high state of, you know, readiness, the ready for attack state, stressful over time. And so, you know, if it were a pendulum, your pendulum will always be high on this side and it would be down on the other side. And so what can you do to sort of right the pendulum? And bring the other side up, the relaxation side. Everybody can do something, right? No matter who you are. And it'll sound very simplistic, but it's true. And I would say start with breathing. The way I talk to people about breathing, because we don't think about our breath. The breath is so critical to reducing stress. You learn how to do it right. So the easiest thing is to ask people just to sit somewhere. They can do this on the bus. Even if the bus is crazy all around you, you can still do this on the bus. Breathe in for four, live for four, breathe out for four. And just keep doing that over and over. And all you're thinking about in that moment, in those moments, is your breath. It's a simple thing anybody can do anytime, anywhere, even in a meeting. The other thing is some sort of activity. So the people who've told me, well, I don't feel comfortable working out in my neighborhood or exercising outside, there are any number of things you can do in your house. Do you have chairs in your house? Sit down and get up from the chair 25 times. You can get on the floor and try to do something because your physical strength, like muscle strength, is so important, especially as you age. Because one of the biggest factors that increases the death rate for older people is something related to not having enough strength, falling and breaking your hip. One of the worst injuries for older people, but how do you guard against that? It's by keeping your muscles strong. But if people are comfortable in their neighborhood and they feel like it's okay to be outside, walking 20 minutes a day to start. That's it. You can't walk 20 minutes a day, I'll take 5. The idea is to get consistently in the habit of moving your body, stretching, because there is a lot of pain and injury that comes with being sedentary or sitting around watching too much TV or just sitting around, you know, all day. The final thing I'll say that people forget that actually can balance these hormones with people you love and care about, so friends and family, dancing and singing. Black people love to sing and dance. That's something you can do in your house. You don't have to go outside. You can turn on, you know, put a playlist together. Almost everybody has a smartphone now. You could get the free Pandora. Put that, you know, R&B playlist on or whatever it is that makes you move. These are all things that will balance our hormones, but we have to do them on a regular basis, like something every day. Because that stress is going to be there, rumbling along, making you sick. So you have to counteract it.
And not only making you sick, Dr. Lisa, but lashing out on others around you. And sometimes in a violent way. So this is what I was thinking when you were talking, that I don't think we understand the importance of good health. That's why we don't prioritize it. Because I know people ask me all the time, do I have a regular regimen? And I really don't, but I think it does fit into what you just said. I'm going to be active to doing something at some point during the day. So when I look at a week, I was active, like, I might march in place at home, you know, when you say you can't go out and march in place, or I might dance. I have a whole thing on Pandora, my dance thing. So, and I like going out into the park, but I think if you don't say I got to go to the gym for an hour and work out all the
time, right,
then you're going to say, that's too much. But if you just make it so simple and then talk about how it helps your mental, physical, and psychological being, then people, I think, would understand better. But, you know.
Notice all those things are free.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I still think it goes back even around the image, beauty images and what we prioritize. If we say that, you know, the chemicals on your hair is going to impact you in terms of, first of all, losing hair, and also, we don't know what those chemicals do to skin. And so maybe you may not want to do that or give your hair a break over time. But I think about, sometimes I would say, some of this stuff is made up. You know, who ever heard of shaky leg syndrome? And who ever heard of irritable bowel syndrome? I said, these dudes are making this stuff up so they can prescribe something. And then I would come across people who have it. I'm like, oh. Okay, so maybe.
But a lot of those things could be treated by reducing inflammation in your body. So these activities we were talking about, the kind of foods you eat. So if you eat a lot of greasy fried foods, you eat a lot of sugar. Like if I had to pick one thing I wanted people to drastically reduce in their diet, it's sugar. trend, you know, so many things we eat that have added sugar. I'm not talking about fruit. Fruit is great, plus it's full of fiber and vitamins, and it's good for your digestion. But most of the stuff you buy in the grocery store, especially all the sweet stuff, we overconsume that. The juices on the shelf, sodas, all of those beverages, the sugary coffee beverages. So I want people to look at that label on the back before they drink it. Make sure they see how many grams of sugar are there, because you probably shouldn't have more than 20 grams of sugar all day long, unless you're working out like crazy or you're so active you need the fuel. Because most of us overconsume sugar, cookies, ice cream. I don't want to say brand names, like people get upset.
You know, I love sweets, and you know, I feel like if that's my only vice, then you know, maybe I could deal with it. But the other thing is, when you get more aware of sugar and you start looking at the label, then you're like, why are they putting sugar in this? Like, why are they putting sugar in ketchup? I mean, sometimes you don't even need to have it in there, and then you think, oh, they want us to be addicted to this stuff so that we don't have all these other symptoms. And particularly if you are prone to being diabetic, now you start seeing some new stuff in your body. So, you know, when I think about who owns this healthcare crisis that Black folks are in, and you talk a little bit about we have to own some of it ourselves in terms of changing our lifestyle. But, you know, what policies and practices do you think would help mitigate the environment that's being created? Because if you're able, and not just you, I'm saying that it's a big you, if we're able to find and relegate people to a zip code and tell you your life expectancy is 15 years lower than the code across the way, what is that? And how do we then say our government has a role, you know, pharmaceuticals have a role, who owns it, and what policy can we help put in place for ourselves to say, we need some protection from you, Mr. Government. You know, we're doing all we can, but if you're allowing all this other stuff to happen, then we just swimming upstream. Is there anything that stands out for you in terms of a policy that would really sort of be a deal breaker in helping to unleash our most healthiest potential?
It has to be food policy. So are there subsidies for grocers to come in to communities? What kind of food is being offered? Like, why is it in so many of our communities you have to get your food in the corner store or at a rundown grocery store that doesn't have good produce and fresh meat? Why are there more liquor stores in a lot of our communities? And it helps perpetuate the sickness when there's no investment in these communities. But coupled with that, you can't just do that. You also have to educate. You have to help people understand why it's important to make these choices and what the long-term impact is on you and your family, your kids. Do you want, you know, if, you know, grandma had to be in a wheelchair like 20 years before the lady across town, like, why was that? What happened? How do you prevent that for the kids coming behind her? But sometimes we just don't know. We're unaware. We don't know about the resources that are there. It's not about just putting in farmers markets, because how much food can you buy at a farmers market? After a couple of days, there has to be something more sustainable than that. And so does the education to help people understand once you get this food, let's say the groceries become available, get home, what are you going to do with it? Do you know how to cook a rutabaga? You know, do you know how to cook a beet? Right? So I think we still have a long way to go to provide the support and resources around food. And I think if you can help people, and this is what I want us to do at Grapevine, to help people understand the impact of eating so much sugar every day on your body. You give people the information and then let them make a decision about the changes they want to make. Because that's a choice. When you go into the grocery store and your basket is more full of juices and cookies and ice cream and snacks than it is fruits and vegetables and lean meats, that's choice. And people have also, I've told you, I've heard everything. Well, I know I'm supposed to eat fruits and vegetables, but it goes bad too fast. Well, because when you get home, you have to actually make the time and cook it into a meal. Or a lot of things you can just eat raw. And so some of this is just changing our palate. And I'll give you a personal example. I used to eat a lot of, brownies and cookies. That's not a good example. I used to drink a lot of ginger beer, and that's a non-alcoholic drink, but it is loaded with sugar. But you know what I did? I started making my own. So now I sweeten it with dates. Sometimes I might use a little bit of raw honey, but the point is I'm controlling how much sugar is in my drink. Because that stuff you buy off the shelf, it doesn't have nutritional value and it's full of sugar. And so again, and these are hard because it's changing our behavior. It's back to why doctors prescribe pills. It's hard to change someone's behavior. So here's the pill.
You gave me a different perspective on that because I'm one of the ones who talk about how physicians are playing to the big pharma. And, you know, it can't always be about pills, even the most holistic doctors will say, you have to resort to Western medicine and you got to resort to pills. But I think the point that you make about in the interim, what are you going to do for that patient until they get the understanding of how to better control their diet? And I think about, for example, we have a youth program and, you know, tried a couple of times to do granola bars for snacks or organic juice boxes. And those kids, like, what is this? They wouldn't drink it.
But look at that organic juice, though. Look at that organic juice. Just look at the label and see how much sugar is in it. It's added sugar. It is not fruit from a fruit.
But in this case, it wasn't. But that's what they were yearning for. They were yearning for more sugar. Like, so it didn't taste like what they were used to. And they're like, So I know the interim is part of getting used to it. Because part of the juices that I started doing, but I have a sister that's a diabetic, and she is a brand of juices that don't taste all that good when you first started, but then you acquire taste for it. But it's specifically, I think it's Healthy Balance or something, she kind of found out from some other folks, but you know, you do have to get a taste for it, and you do have to get acclimated to it, but in the interim, that means we gotta really work hard to convince our parents and our families to give up when they're trying to introduce something new and healthy, because if you're not used to it, you're like, no more, don't send me no more of that stuff.
Yeah, no, you know, the acquiring taste is hard. And so I actually don't recommend that too much just because I know it doesn't work, because you either like something or you don't. So how do you transition? So I transitioned off whole milk. I'm actually going back to whole milk, but I transitioned off whole milk to 1% by just gradually decreasing it until I didn't notice it. You can also mix it with something you like and then decrease the proportions over time. And then that's how you train your palate to like something different. But just to ask people to acquire a new taste, like I feel like they're like, talk to the hand. No, thank you. it's a really hard one. But I also think we need to be more adventurous with our eating. There are so many different foods we can try. We have to be willing to try. And seasoning, you don't have to use salt on everything. You can use a dash of salt, which is great for flavor enhancement. But, you know, citrus, lemons and limes, garlic, balsamic vinegar, all of these things can add rich, rich flavor to foods. And so there's a bit of an experiment if we're willing. The other thing I wanted to mention that I forgot about, people say fresh fruits and vegetables are too expensive. The frozen food aisle has some really cheap vegetables. And those vegetables are what they call flash frozen. So as soon as it comes off the vine, gets cut, it gets frozen. It retains some of its vitamins and nutrients, and it's certainly better than what you'll get in a can. And they're economical. So, you know, I don't know, a pack of cookies can be pretty expensive compared to a frozen bag of broccoli.
It's really expensive.
Oh, I haven't bought that in a while. Okay,
I haven't, but I hear that from parents who got kids and they're paying $6-$7 a box. Well, I remember when we were coming up, it was like $1.29 a box. But yeah, the whole food thing is really, really, really popular.
Yeah. And people who
Lisa, when you talk about the fresh, the frozen vegetables, oftentimes what we will do is black folks is like cook all the nutrients out where it's not.
Yeah,
because we're so used to, for example, green beans. If they're like crunchy, that means they're not cooked. So we're going to cook them to like dark green.
I need to study where that came from, you know, that ritual of cooking things until they're dark green. Like I love greens. My mother makes greens and they're so good. But you know, a lot to ask people to change these generational habits that have just been passed down and sort of the attitudes about food. But until we get this awareness, we can't advocate for these policies you're talking about. People will be fine with us buying box macaroni and cheese and Spam in the corner store because we either don't know any better, we don't know to advocate for it because we don't know the long-term impact of eating, you know, those foods, you know, for decades and decades. Food is medicine. That's the phrase. Food is medicine.
Yeah. And that's a good thing to remember and actually how we can actually take that slogan and make it widespread because I don't think people see. They see it more as, well, in many ways it is, what is it, the endorphins or something in our brains that it does.
I mean, you know, I had some rum raisin ice cream the other day and I hadn't had any ice cream and my eyes were rolling back in my head. It was so good. And I wanted some more. I was like, but that's the idea, right? So if you can, you know, get people hooked on these things and sugar is, you know, it's addicting.
And I've seen even the dramatic way that folks have tried to make us aware where they would say, this is how much sugar is in what you eat, and it'll be a mound of sugar, and it really brings it home. Wow. That's accumulating in our bodies, what is the impact of that over time? Everything we eat has a mound of sugar. So I think, and I circled in my note here about the food policy being the important piece of how we can break this cycle of bad health, you know, break the cycle of all of these conditions that disproportionately affect Black people, that we have to own that piece. But I also know that we have to struggle for policies that can be reinforced and enforced by our government to help keep us healthy. Because, you know, health, the right to good health is actually a universal human right. And so if that's being denied us, then we have to find ways to go beyond our families, beyond our communities to make sure that people are doing what they need to do.
We speak up for our health, right? And I think our churches can take the lead on this. I mean, how many church buffets have you seen that are probably not the best for us? Like, I'm not going to call people out, but just think about what is on the church buffet or the, you know, the potluck at the church. And is that stuff we should be eating on a regular basis, right? So we have to lead by example.
Absolutely.
I also just want to let people know one thing before we leave this topic. The reason we tell people to reduce sugar because it leads to diabetes is because it oversaturates your system with sugar. Then over time, the insulin, which is a hormone that is responsible for breaking down and getting rid of sugar, over time it doesn't even recognize that it needs to act. This is that metaphor with the frog that boils to death. So if you put a frog in a pot of boiling water, it's out immediately because it senses the danger. But if you put it in the water and you heat it 1 degree at a time, it'll boil to death, right? And so think about it in those terms. So if you put the right amount of sugar in, then the insulin wakes up. It's like, oh, okay, let me get rid of that. But if you just keep bombarding your body with sugar and then the insulin, it's just like, oh, that's just sugar, right? And then it's what we call insulin resistance. So insulin is no longer responding in the way it's supposed to eliminate sugar. And that's what creates diabetes. So people know, okay, it has something to do with your sugar, but there's really something like going on inside your body. Like physiologically, this is what's happening when you eat too much. And it's not just sugar, it's carbs.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Dr. Lisa, I have certainly learned a lot today, and I'm so glad that we had you on the show. And can you give that number out again if people have an issue, a health issue that they want to text you?
202-702-8175.
So let me helping to promote that number too, because I think sometimes people just have a question and rather go to the internet, start trying to find something. They have a credible messenger right here with Dr. Lisa. So thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. And this is Jamala Rogers of Voices from the Battlefield. We'll be with you next week.